Hey there. Welcome to the Total Connector Show. My name is Kevan Davani. This is going to be my first recap, the Total Bitcoin, Total Connector episode, a special series of episodes with different guests in the future. And my first guest and co-host is Thibaut Marechal, which I already had him on for a great interview. You should definitely listen to this. And let me know what you think. If you have any questions, inspirations, suggestions, please write me at hello@thetotalconnector.com or kd@kevandavani.com. Or you can write me, direct message me on Twitter or what have you. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks so much for listening. And I'm already excited to hear what you think, what you feel, and have fun.
Welcome to the Total Connector Show. My name is Kevan Davani. This is a new series I want to start with Tip. I intend to do this on a regular basis. Tip, first of all, thank you so much again for your time coming on my show.
Thank you for having me, Kevan. I'm glad to participate in that.
Yeah, Tip. It's great talking to you because you have a really, a broad perspective, holistic knowledge on a lot of aspects of Bitcoin, what's going on. And again, you are, let me just for the for any listeners, you are at Nux Custody, right? Is that?
Yeah, that's right. Nux, exactly. A Bitcoin custodian. Mm-hmm.
So what I want to do is, like, on a regular basis, I'm going to try to do this every week or every second week, to do sort of a recapitulation of everything that's been going on within a week or two, substantial, really important events or happenings in the Bitcoin space or in the environment of Bitcoin. So what I want to start off is, because I find it pretty hilarious, is an article which is on zerohedge.com. The title is called "Peak Irony: Fed Paper Admits Fed Policy Can Lead to Economic Ruin." And I find it pretty hilarious because it's coming now from all sides. They now have to admit themselves that the Fed's own policy could lead to economic ruin. Oh, really? So they're using all kinds, and they've been criticized from every direction you can imagine. Using euphemism for quantitative easing, whatever that is, buying up more bonds or treasuries, and pumping up the balance sheet. There's all kinds of, I think there's somebody on Twitter where they list all these euphemism, these sort of circumvention of quantitative easing. And then it says here, "We've seen this song and dance before. The Federal Reserve ran three rounds of quantitative easing in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, blah, blah." And Waller and Freraking, I think it might be the authors, assure us everything will be fine here in the US. Or I don't know who they're quoting. "We don't have to worry about hyperinflation because we have an independent central bank." So
right.
This travesty, I don't know what to call it, this clown theater puppet show, what do you make of this?
Yeah, where to start? This is a broad one. I mean, the Federal Reserve is a great marketing agency. Mm-hmm. They will find different ways to explain what they're doing, which is basically, printing money, which is a institutionalized theft from currency holders, and counterfeiting, right? But taking a step back from this, I was just browsing the web last time, looking at what the Federal Reserve was and what its history was. And quick note, the Federal Reserve has nothing federal, and doesn't have reserves.
Finally, yeah, somebody said it.
And so that's funny, right? Because it is a for-profit corporation with shareholders. The government of the United States is part of that cap table, I should say. Mm-hmm. But it's a, I think, sure, it's a majority shareholders, perhaps 15 or 20%. Don't quote me on this, but I think it's along those lines. And the rest is made of other shareholders that we don't really know who they are. And that you can also verify that on Wikipedia or other sources online. And so it has nothing to do with, you know, it's not federal, it's not government backed per se, partially only. And then in terms of reserves, well, you know, we both know that the United States currency, the dollar, isn't backed by anything. So, yeah, I just find that interesting. Now, in terms of the recent activity of the Fed, and specifically, you know, the trigger that was caused by the spike of interest in the overnight lending market, was quite shocking to many insiders in Wall Street and in the markets. But if you look at broader mainstream media, not a lot of people talk about this. It's been quite kept on the down low thus far. And who knows what will happen out of it. Markets can stay irrational for a long time. You know, we're seeing now asset prices are at all-time high. Trump bragging about, you know, the stock market hitting new all-time highs. And the reality is people who just read the headlines, and that is unfortunately most people, will see it as a good thing because they treat growth as a net positive, but they don't take into account all the misallocation of capital, all the malinvestments that are brought by easy money, by money printing, by liquidity injection, by quantitative easing, call it what you want. It's the same thing, right? One figure that particularly shocked me in those recent financial markets activities is the corporate debt market that has been really spiking recently. Mm-hmm. I think over the last figures I had was from January of this year to this September. I don't have the latest figures, but it basically, the total market cap of corporate debt that is negative yielding, roughly 50x. And so, meaning that you have a lot of companies that are borrowing money and they're paid to do so. And what they've been doing recently is they basically do what is called share buybacks.
Exactly.
So using that very cheap debt.
Yeah, on a massive scale. On a massive scale. And then, you know, people are surprised that, you know, a market valuation of companies, you know, go into the, nearly like a trillion. I mean, this is what Apple has been doing all the way along, right?
And the reality, you cannot blame these companies.
Of course.
If you think about it, like these companies, like they have a mandate, which is they got to make money and they got to make money in real terms. So they have to constantly be distracted by their debasing inflationary currencies. So if you're an American company, it's okay, but still. And so that's why all these companies do all these weird things, and that's why they have internal trading desks like Apple, Amazon, and all these companies. They do have trading desks to manage, you know, FX, and many other things that I'm not even aware of. And so when you think about it, this is another really good example of malinvestment of money, because that inflationary currency, they just distract these businesses from being able to provide value to their customers. And so anyway, just going back to the share buybacks, you're creating another bubble, right? You have this negative yielding debt that is growing at an alarming rate, and that is feeding another bubble, which is the one we mentioned, the stock market bubble. So when does it all stop? Where does the trigger appear to pierce through that bubble? I have no idea. And
yeah,
I don't think a lot of people know this.
Yeah. And let's not forget, there was a really interesting report or episode with, Stacey Herbert, Max Kaiser, the Kaiser Report,
right,
a while ago,
right,
like, I don't know, several weeks ago. And they talked about Boeing doing all these share buybacks and, being in this sort of under investigation because of the security malfeasance, the threat and the dangers and the lives that have been lost actually because of the security issues and the consequences of not allocating enough resources to research, development, security updates or whatever have you, like on engineering side. So because you mentioned share buybacks, the CEOs, the executives, the shareholders, they have been actually profiting, but at the expense of directly or indirectly at the expense of the security of the Boeing airplanes. So this is right, unbelievable, real. So, but because they're so intertwined or interconnected with the military-industrial complex, probably we're not going to see much of a legal consequence for them, because it's everything is then under the name of national security. You can just compartmentalize it and put it under the rug, as to say. So I find this aspect pretty interesting, that what is misallocation really mean then, in the grander scheme.
That's a great question. The issue, I think, is the point you brought, which is the intertwined connections between government and for-profit entities that are utilizing quote unquote public or common resources at the expense of the people at the bottom who are in cash, for instance, and who are seeing that their currency being diluted and losing purchasing power against goods in the economy as the money ripples down and the Cantillon effect appears, right?
What's so funny when you say that? Yeah, you see the dilution, the inflationary effect, the debasement of money. This is what they're really good at. It's like this classical proverbial example with a frog in the water. Where you warm up the water like gradually, like one Celsius after one Celsius, and eventually the water gets warmer, and then eventually hot, and the frog just doesn't notice it. And this is where we are. This is the matrix we're born into. But people, because it's so slow, it's because they're so distracted, and it's the process is so slow, they just don't perceive it as as being stolen from,
Right. And to build on that analogy, I believe this, boiling water is appearing to kill a few frogs in other neighbor countries, right? I mean, you look at what's happening in Venezuela, of course, but Argentina, what happened in Iran or Turkey, or, and you sort of start like trying to analyze what mechanism led to this, and you realize that, look, this is the exact same system that we have in the United States, in Europe, and in many other countries in the world. It's just a matter of maturity. These countries are just further down the line of fractional central banking, and easy money. And so at some point, you're going to have governments who will abuse this power that they have, even though, you know, all these governments claim that central banks are independent entities. You know, there's clearly an influence. And when central banks conduct what they call open market operations, which is essentially a country issuing bonds to finance different programs, well, the central bank from that country is not only allowed, but will purchase part of that offering of debt. And in order to do that, they will literally print money out of thin air and put that debt on their balance sheet.
So this is what is called like monetization of the debt, right?
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, and they're pretty open about it now. So I just wonder what will be the trigger. Now you have, again, Trump barking at the head of the Fed on Twitter, saying insane. That they're all assholes not lowering the interest rates and that the United States should go into negative, you know, territories. He's, again, super open about this on Twitter, which I find it's phenomenal. What a time to be alive.
So this is just insane. Yeah, it's really a matrix. But anyway, let me see what there are some other, couple of other points I wanted to bring. You brought up this question when you explained how long this could go on. You know, it's really we can't predict, but it's really interesting, like, to think about how long the system, or, you know, the central banks, inclusion with the governments, can procrastinate, you know, fueling up this bubble. Like how far can you go into this bubble? I mean, when is the point where it's gonna burst? This is a really good question, and I'm sure they can for, you know, some time, maybe even for, you know, for years, for 10 years.
It's hard, right? Because fiat as a monetary system is an experiment. I like to bring this very simple fact of life, which is that the euro as a currency, and I'm French, so I've been through the change from like the franc to the euro. I remember that pretty well. And this currency, the euro, and you're a part of it as well, is only 17 years old.
it's really experiment. Oh my God.
Bitcoin is 11 years old.
Yeah, and look where we are. Right? Yeah.
So look where we are. There's not a big difference in terms of like a system that is time tested. And I would argue that, of course, Bitcoin is much more robust and anti-fragile as a monetary system than the euro is, because the euro is, you know, of course, like politically exposed, and anyway, there's a lot of other economic activity that will influence how the currency price fluctuates. But anyway, the point is that overall, fiat currency is an experiment, and so, particularly post 08, the quantitative easing, and you look at, there are a lot of great resources out there from, you know, Crypto Voices, Matthew Majinski and Fernando are doing phenomenal work on that. Mr. Cool BP, Ben Prentice, shout out to this guy. He's done, What the Fuck Happened in 1971, and also has a lot of really interesting data regarding the expansion of monetary base layers. You just realize how influential that is on all economic activity, the debasement of currencies. And so, yeah, we don't really know when that experiment will end, but it looks like there are early signals or even advanced signs in other economies of the world that this system is failing, and that it's just, you know, widening the wealth gap, as again the Cantillon effect sort of goes full blast, pumping asset prices where capital owners are actually exposed, and then just diluting the currency and its purchasing power where all the, you know, paycheck to paycheck people who don't have assets are. And so you're just broadening inequality in a given economy, and that is bad for many reasons. It's unfair because the cost is socialized to the bottom layer of the population, and it's the benefits are concentrated and extracted upward in that pyramid where only the rich can access that upside. Right. And if we want to speculate a little bit on how that system could break in the United States or in Europe, I mean, there are many avenues, many candidate scenarios. One of which I find really interesting and timely is the pension fund market. For instance, my parents are going to retire in the next 5 years because they're, you know, they're boomers. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are about to retire in the next 5 years to 10 years. Yeah. A lot. In Europe in particular, but the United States. And so, you know, we often talk about external debt of countries, you know, the sovereign debt figures that we always refer to. And so, for instance, in the US, it's $22 trillion, which is roughly 104% of GDP, which is insane, right? But that is only external. There's internal debt, also called unfunded liabilities. And that is much bigger. Yeah. And in the United States, for instance, it's roughly $200 trillion.
That's insane. Yeah. Yeah.
And this unfunded liabilities is another word to say, and it encapsulates other things, but it's mostly pension. So basically, the United States owing money to people who are about to retire. Yeah. Or who are retired and are looking to get, you know, the money back under the form of a monthly stipend. And this money that they've sort of contributed to their 401ks or pension programs every month that they've been working in the United States, right? Mm-hmm. And the reality is these unfunded liabilities, because they're so large, and I don't have the figures in Europe, but I'll look into it because it's interesting. Basically, today, if things were to, you know, stay as what they are, governments are insolvent.
Yeah.
Like if you were to treat them as rational economic actors who need to manage cash flow like a business, they're insolvent.
Yeah, but and the banks too. The banks are insolvent too. Look at Germany. I mean, they're going to crash.
Right.
It's
oh, right, right. You look at the Deutsche Bank is like insane stuff going on there. I suspect they are the bank that made the repo market rate pump. But who knows? Mm-hmm. That's another speculative opinion of mine.
Let me add, you know, again, you know, the global debt, like if you calculate all the unfunded liabilities, that's why you get this, this crazy number of 1.8 to up to 2 quadrillion US dollars. Because if you add, you know, derivatives, unfunded liabilities to the global debt, this is, you know, unimaginable. Yeah, I mean, people can't even grasp that.
You know? Unfathomable. I was going to say, how many zeros is that? Oh. Is it 15 zeros? I don't know. It's a lot of zeros.
Yeah.
But just finishing my stream of consciousness for that unfunded liability. The problem is, it's not going to go down because you have negative interest rates, and particularly in the bond market, whether it's like we said, corporate debt or sovereign debt, which is sovereign debt. I think it's roughly 18 trillion now. And corporate is around 1 trillion, but and that figures, you know, they've been growing over time. And anyway, the managers that are responsible to, you know, make the right capital allocations for these pension funds, because they're basically collecting money from taxpayers, right, in the form of income tax every month in the US, in Europe, in any country. And these fiduciaries are supposed to meet return targets. And I think for pension funds, it's roughly 7% in real, or even let's say nominal to be conservative. Mm-hmm. So let's say, you know, 5% real. Well, the reality is part of their mandate, because they are supposed to invest in long-term horizons, their mandate requires them to have an allocation, a material allocation to bonds and debt, right? With long maturity cycles. And the reality is these instruments today of long maturity cycles are yielding negative interest rates. And so all of a sudden you have these massive funds that by mandate are allocated to these bond positions and that are yielding negative interest rates. And so what do you do now as a fund manager who's, you know, got a fiduciary duty to bring that return? You got to think of other alternatives. And also, if those bonds are lowering further down their interest rates, at some point the classification of those instruments will go down. They'll get downgraded. And if you move, I think the limit is triple B. If you move in that zone, you're not an investment grade product anymore. And that is a particular threshold which prevents those fiduciaries from holding positions in those assets. Right. And if that happens, then what happens? Well, you got to sell. And that sell pressure is just going to basically trigger a massive amount of divesting from these assets. And therefore, you know, cutting the demand, and therefore, you know, price go down, and all of a sudden you have a system that's collapsing. I don't know. It's a bit of a complex avenue to explore, and I haven't sort of built all the mental models to make sense of it. But I think it's a very interesting avenue, and very scary also.
Yeah. No, but you gave a pretty good overview. Thanks so much. So I have a couple of other points I've written down. We don't have to cover all of them, but I just want to have maybe, you know, you can maybe pick some of them. I had an interview, a really amazing interview with Zia from Iran. Because I've never been to Iran since 1979, 1980. So it was really amazing, like getting a deep insight, you know, what's going on. We couldn't talk about some stuff because, you know, he's in Iran. So there are some sensitive issues, of course, with, you know, the stupid regime and the protests, and you know, probably, you know, I do look at it a little bit nuanced. There's protests, and then we got the riots. So I think partially it's been instigated, you know, but on the other hand, there is a dissatisfaction because of, you know, social economical pressure because of rising whatever fuel prices, and that was the triggering point. So anyway, so and I talked about him, you know, what could be the solution when. Because there was an internet shutdown down to, I don't know, it was at the beginning, like down to 2-4%, like blackout, you know? And so now it's been rising again. Now, you know, there've been sort of
activating the internet again. But there's a lot of people, he told me, like many, like probably most people are using VPN, in order to access the internet, you know, in a sort of a censorship resistant private way. And I talked to him, you know, what could be the, you know, sustainable solution? And the only way like to circumvent all this, you know, repression and oppression and censorship and surveillance and what have you is a really mature development in the satellite local mesh network radio frequencies technology, you know, such as what is it called? Like, okay, there's Gotenna, there is this guy who I talked to, Locha, don't know the name, sorry about that. Let me see, Locha Tenna or some. Yeah, anyway, so and then Blockstream. So I think it's not going to take so much longer. You know, it's not going to take years, but with a little bit more development, a little more resources, investment money from investors, I think this could be a viable, super like alternative accessing. First of all, you know, making transactions, Bitcoin transactions. Mm-hmm. And sending messages. And I want to do a series of episodes with experts, would it be Richard Myers from Gotenna or what's his name? Also with Zia and from Iran. And there's this other guy I talked to yesterday. Let me look it up. He's a developer in this space. His name is Randy Brito. Randy Brito, right. from Locha. It's called Locha. Yeah. So it's really amazing stuff going on, and I think this could be an awesome solution to the censorship, to the oppressive tactics that whatever regime government is using, whether it's be in Venezuela or in Iran. So like what's your take on that? I mean, do you think this we are going towards the point is it's independent of the internet. That's what I'm talking about.
Right. It's a fascinating movement. At the genesis of its maturity, mm-hmm. I believe, and it's just getting started, and it's not going to stop. I mean, I've tried to play with Gotenna and mesh network, and I'm not deeply technical at all, but also just looking at the network, last time I looked in Montreal, there was 12 different Gotennas, which is like, it's a respectable number, but it's far from making this usable in town. But like you say, you know, in Iran, where the internet was shut down to 2-3% for, I think it was a week long shutdown.
Almost, yeah, probably.
Which
is
insane. Yeah. For sure, it's for sure people are going to find ways. And it really is a humbling reminder of how awesome mankind and humans are. And how anti-fragile we are on the individual level. And so, you know, we talked about this last time, I think, Bitcoin being the economic powerhouse for the rise of the sovereign individual. Mm-hmm. And global mesh networking is a beautiful illustration of sovereign individuals taking a stance for their personal liberties, mm-hmm. and celebrating that at a local scale to fight, you know, government abusing powers and trying to shut down the internet. And so,
And also sanctions and embargoes, you know, a tip, right. You know, like sanctions and embargoes, the people are suffering. There are 80 million people in Iran, 80 million, 80. And they're also, they have an urgent need. I mean, this is a huge market, you know, just give them like a kit, like an Android smartphone kit with an antenna. And there you go. I mean, you're independent.
Oh,
you're free,
yeah.
You know,
it's amazing. You know, you take Blockstream satellite beaming, you know, blocks from space, then you use Gotenna as a last mile delivery system to do business and just like have economic activity happen between individuals. Governments cannot interfere with this. You're removing the sort of ISP level attack surface, because you know we all know that ISPs are super concentrated.
Mm-hmm.
You're sort of like nullifying that all of a sudden, and combine that with the Lightning Network and this new early protocol called WhatsApp that they've built, which is this censorship resistant open source messaging system on Lightning, and you can talk to people you know, in a censorship resistant manner privately.
Right.
Because we both know that Lightning is truly underrated for its privacy enhancing properties. And so it's amazing. It really is the next, perhaps the next wave of the internet. The next wave of infrastructure is going to be just mesh based networking. And whether you're transacting value using Bitcoin and Lightning, using Gotenna and Blockstream satellites, or talking to your friends across the world in, you know, censored regions with WhatsApp and whatnot.
And combine it with the radio frequencies, you know, that you cannot in any way scramble, or because they would shoot themselves in the foot. I talked to someone, you know, the guy said, it's impossible. You can't even switch the radio frequency because the military, the government, they're using themselves like all kinds of frequencies. So if they, you know, attack or try to scramble, they're actually shooting themselves in the foot, you know, because they're using themselves this infrastructure of whatever frequencies, you know, technology.
Yeah, I think we're going into a beautiful world of Mad Max, and I can totally see, you know, the cyber truck being part of this.
It's a breakaway civilization, but for the first time, like for really for, you know, huge majority, like a huge portion of you know, of the Earth's population. I think this is where we're heading to, because there's no other way. Look at all the uprisings and protests everywhere going on. It's like crazy.
Yeah, no, it's what a time to be alive. It's amazing seeing this happen in real time. And of course, there's a lot of pain and suffering in countries where people are protesting. But it's just beautiful to see that in the end, like individual people are together in that movement and seeking to break free from the oppressive behaviors of nation states. It's fascinating to observe. And
yeah.
And I can't wait to see more people just set themselves free of that.
Yeah, the speed is incredible. Yeah, which is going. As a reminder, not your keys, not your coins. I just wanted to, you know, there was this hack with all these shit coins on Upbit exchange with, I mean, who leaves like, what was it, like 350,000 ETH or whatever? It's $50 million worth on a hot wallet. I mean, this is crazy. Now there's some, you know, conspiracies and theories, like, you know, because of tax and the allegedly hackers were like, I don't know, just stories, you know, begging the exchange like to do like a half sharing of the coins, because then the exchange could then deduct the taxes, like, you know, make sort of a, I don't even know whether that's true. So it might be just a rumor, But whatever it is, you know, who leaves like so much, you know, fiat worth, whatever coins or shit coins or whatever on an exchange, you know, would it be ETH or whatever?
Yeah. It's an unfortunate reminder of that. Yeah. Not your keys, not your Bitcoins, or not your keys, not your shit coins. It works as well.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, as a side note, you know, obviously, you know, I work at a company providing custody services, but so it's like, okay, like this guy is distorting narratives, but actually I truly believe that everybody should hold their own keys and run their own node. But when you have, for instance, the case of exchanges holding keys, I think this is an absurd behavior that came out of necessity. Mm-hmm. Because exchanges, they're supposed to match orders between buyers and sellers, between, you know, takers and makers, and take a spread between that, you know, the bid and ask price. They're not supposed to be doing market making like they're doing. They're not supposed to be doing custody of their customers' funds. They're supposed to get distribution, mm-hmm. and grow the liquidity of their order book. That's pretty much it. Yeah. And so you have exchanges doing that, very few. Actually, I only know of one, and it's our neighbor. It's Bull Bitcoin, led by Francis Puglio and Vincent and all these great guys, Etienne Keksky. They understood that the risk of holding keys just doesn't make sense from a business standpoint. It basically is only, it's a liability as an exchange, right? Because at the end of the day, you don't make any money by doing custody of your customers' funds, unless you charge for this. But even if you were to charge for this, it would be a very small amount of money that you're making, as opposed to just like the exchange business. So yeah, I really hope that either people understand that they should not hold their keys on exchanges, because exchanges are not designed to do this. And the teams operating these exchanges, even though they're super well-intentioned, they're busy working on many different things. And custody is, you know, the last sort of, it very important, because that's where they hold most of their funds. But it's just a cost center for them. There's no revenue coming out of this. And mm-hmm. so this is where I believe that in the future, you're going to see more regulatory position papers, like the ones that was shared by the Hong Kong supervising agencies, that said that, for instance, exchanges who are custodial in nature, or any other custodial entity mm-hmm. managing Bitcoin, and I think they included digital assets, need to have at least 90 to 95% of insurance. Like, it's a requirement, because the counterparty risk is that big.
Wow.
So okay. Either you're going to see these businesses go and seek insurance policies, but the premiums are going to be extremely high, because their systems were not designed to accommodate for that type of policy. Right. Mm-hmm. Or you're going to see specialization segregation of functions between custody, between trading, between market making, between all these things. Or you're going to see a third option, which is people are going to be truly sovereign, and they're going to hold their own keys, and they're going to use CASA, or they're going to use Unchained Capital, and you know, which are acting as part of collaborative custody models. So you're still sovereign in a way. So I truly see these scenarios play out in the future, and I believe they will all be true and exist as people in the marketplace have just different risk appetites and risk tolerance. And so some will want to do collaborative custody. Some will want to delegate their keys, their Bitcoin.
Oh yeah, there will be a lot of people
specialized entities
still, you know, insisting on custodial or semi-custodial, because, you know, especially when, you know, we have, you're really dealing with substantial amounts, or people who, you know, might not be able, like old people. It doesn't need to be old people, but like, you know, people who are,
Again, I think you look at traditional fiduciaries. If you're a fiduciary and you're investing in, so you're managing other people's assets, there's a principal agent relationship to capital. You're not used to doing custody of your assets. You know, you're building investment theses, you're executing those theses with the right amount of risk management controls in place to make sure that you're meeting your duty as a fiduciary. And custody is not a direct part of this. You gotta do custody right, but you're actually delegating that function of your operations to a trusted third party. And so that's why you have today these massive custodial banks like BNY Mellon and State Street. They hold in the tens of trillions of dollars worth of securities and other assets. Wow. And so these managers, the point that I wanted to make is these managers are not used to doing custody, A, and B, particularly when it comes to bearer asset. I mean, the custody of a bearer asset is extremely risky. Yeah. Who's holding it? Who's responsible for that? In case something goes wrong, what is the internal governance model to sign off on transactions? Do we have rate limits? If so, how much? Like, all of these questions like make it extremely hard to deal with, especially if you have the responsibility to hold that asset. And so this is why, again, I do not see a future where fiduciaries are not going to delegate that function of their operations to trust minimized counterparties.
Right, right. I want to go a little bit sidetrack to privacy or coin mixing, because I heard Samurai, I mean, he's doing really, both of them, Wasabi and Samurai, they're really doing a great job in the, least, you know, in the development process, you know, updating and fixing bugs and, you know, adding features, making it maybe even more usable, hopefully, or user-friendly. But Samurai, I think what really excites me is that the mobile version sort of coin mixing, the sort of by default mobile pre and post mixing of coins for the sake of fungibility and privacy will come hopefully in the near future. Now, what would you say? Would you for now, would you recommend to people, like, before they transfer their Bitcoin from the exchange to their hardware wallet, does it make sense to, transfer it to, Samurai's Whirlpool, for example, mix it really good, and then, like, in small portions, finally, and transfer it to the hardware wallet instead of directly, from exchange to hardware wallet?
Right. So I cannot speak for Samurai because I haven't used it. I'm on iPhone. Guilty of that. I still need to get my Android device set up and play around with it. But I'm quite used to Wasabi.
Okay.
And I would say CoinJoin and mixing in particular is not only desirable for your, as a step before storing your Bitcoins for long term, it is absolutely necessary. Mm-hmm. And not only for, the great common good of having fungible Bitcoins, it's to protect yourself. And it is not about fiscal evasion, just like breaking the traceability of your coins from an address that is linked to a KYC data to an address that isn't, but it's more about security and OPSEC. Because you look at all these exchanges today that are required to hold KYC data on their customers, and we have to do it as well as a custodian, and then also additional like anti-money laundering and anti-terrorist financing programs. What this does is that it is putting a lot of data storage requirements on entities providing these functions in the marketplace, so exchanges. And so exchanges have massive amounts of highly sensitive customer data, like their full name, their home address, their government issued IDs, and their balance. And even if the balance is of course separate from the keys, if you have that database breached, all of a sudden you have crazy amount of data that is exposed on these clients, where I can know that John Smith has who's living at this place in Montreal has,
oh my god, this is highly seven, this is highly this is a catastrophe. I mean, this is insane. Just the whole KYC, I mean,
it's insane, right? But the thing is, unfortunately, as businesses operating in that space, particularly exchanges that are touching fiat, they must do this. Otherwise, the directors and officers, in the management, as part of the management team of these companies, basically are committing, fraud or just not meeting the regulatory requirements that are imposed on them by the jurisdiction in which their business is registered or operating. And so, these regulations just make no sense, but more than that, they create tremendous amount of risk. And so to go back to coin joins and mixing, it is to ensure your personal safety, the safety of your family, and your wife, your husband, your kids, like just making sure your whole dwelling is secure and not exposed to these risks. Because unless you're buying non-KYC bitcoins, and this is hard because even like great products like BISC, there's no liquidity on this for now. I tried to look into it in Canada, and like the CAD to BTC market trades at a mega premium, and there are perhaps two sellers or three sellers. So not the best experience. Definitely coin joining is super desirable and necessary. And you have, again, like I'm going to shill Bull Bitcoin, but they're, as an exchange, they're coin joining all their UTXOs before sending them to customers' addresses.
Oh, cool. Excellent.
And Francis made a really interesting position on that, saying that basically as an exchange, in Canada in particular, as a financial services firm, so an exchange is part of that category, you are required to not leak customer information if, of course, the customer didn't give you an explicit consent. Right. And so if you're, he made the argument, which is brilliant, that if you're sending Bitcoins to an address of a customer that is KYC'd, right? Because you've KYC'd that customer, and then that customer goes and like sends it to other addresses because he's like, whatever, he's just moving Bitcoins around. Well, you've just leaked data on your customer because all this data is publicly accessible via the Bitcoin's time chain. And so you are against Canadian laws. You're not regulatory compliant, and that is why CoinJoin in Canada for exchanges and other businesses managing Bitcoin UTXOs should be required. That is sort of the whole argument, and I find it fascinating. It makes a lot of sense from a confidentiality of customer data standpoint, and I hope that we'll see a more formalized position by regulators to enforce that standard. with other entities in the space.
Yeah,
because you look at, again, like blockchain analysis companies, up to a certain point in the amount of mixing that happened, right? The anonymity set, if it's beyond a certain threshold, and I think that threshold is perhaps like, I don't know, 15 or 20, but again, I'm not technical enough to like be super strict on that number. It is impossible basically to trace back those UTXOs. If post mixing UTXO consolidation is not like executed on, because that's another issue, is if you've mixed your Bitcoin UTXOs and then you sort of post mix merge those UTXOs together, then you can expose you can basically make sense of where those UTXOs came from in the first place and basically break the privacy that comes from the previous mixing.
Yeah, because I'm going to speak from my own experience, because I did a stupid thing. I mixed it on, you know, Samurai Whirlpool, and then as one, like one total amount, I transferred it finally, you know, to my hardware wallet, but that makes the whole coin mixing obsolete. So what I was advised to do is like, you know, like do it like in portions, like split it, mm-hmm. split up the amounts, because otherwise it doesn't make sense. You make the whole coin mixing and the, you know, you make the whole, then they, you know, people can, criminal people can finally, you know, track you down, actually, because you linked sort of everything together again, sort of, right? I mean, the way I understand it. Yeah.
Right. No, and it's hard. Privacy is really hard. It's a good reminder that we're still in the very early days of that. And then of course there's, you know, you need to be careful which wallet you're using. And for instance, if you're using Trezor, and you're using their web app, well, the reality is they say they don't log anything, but they log your IP, and your IP can be tied to your identity, and boom, all of a sudden, you know, you've leaked all your personal data again, right? Same thing for the XPub that Trezor may have access to. So again, it's really hard, and it really takes that extra mile of due diligence anytime you're about to take an action, if you want to stay private using Bitcoin.
Excellent. Yeah. So I'm going to keep this as short as possible, so we don't overwhelm my listeners. The only thing that I was just going to say, you know, for final, is that, you know, in the end, we should all understand, as Michael Goldstein, I think, said in the interview with Peter McCormack, he said, it's not sort of Bitcoin is not the end of it. You know, I quote him, it's because of what we believe Bitcoin enables. And I found that, you know, his statement pretty accurate, because, you know, it's not per se the Bitcoin itself, but what we can create, you know, new structures, new ecosystems, new civilization, whatever it is, or new disclosure of technologies in my, you know, from my perspective. So, what it really enables. This is, I think, a good final thought for our recap.
Our show. Very well said. Very, very eloquent and super, super true. It is the rise of the sovereign individual. You know,
exactly.
Monetary sovereignty is the ultimate trigger that will liberate people to do amazing things. Whether it's entrepreneurs being able to make good economic calculation because you have a sound money, or whether it's just being able to use a censorship resistant way to transfer value or save your wealth over time, preserve your wealth over time. I think the sky's the limit, sort of, in terms of what Bitcoin will enable in the next decades. It's yeah, super blessed to be alive right now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Yeah, no, it was beautiful. Dip, thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon. Hopefully we can do this on a regular basis. And yeah, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge.
Man. It was awesome. Yeah. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you so much.
All right. Talk soon. Bye.
Ciao.
Welcome to the podcast show by Kevan Davani, the Total Connector, Total Bitcoin, Austrian Economics, the hardest and scarcest money ever created in human history, Bitcoin.